Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Bob Prohl, author of 100,000 Worlds, released tomorrow by Viking. By the way, Bob will be appearing at Amalgam Comics and Books, great place, on June 30th at 7 p.m. Amalgam is located, as many of you might know, at 2578 Frankfurt, downtown. So you should definitely head on down there. Yeah, he appears at 7 p.m. at Amalgam Comics and Books. So Bob grew up in Buffalo. He's worked at, he did work at Buffalo Street Books. He's been a DJ, a record store owner, and a bartender. And having now, I'm still own a independent bookstore, Wellington Square Books. None of those seem very lucrative. Because I know mine isn't. He was a 2012 New York Foundation for the Arts Fellow in Fiction and a 2013 resident at the Salt and Saul Arts Colony. He's written for 33 and a third books, all of which we have, and I think his album was Grievous Angel by Graham Parsons. We have a copy of that, and not that it's relevant, but I'm a good friend with Graham Parsons' sister. He lives in Ithaca. 100,000 Worlds combines the love between a mother and a son, lots of Comic-Cons in various cities, some more metropolitan and glossy than others, an homage to the history of comics, with lots of parallels between Marvel, DC, action, as well as cities similar to Metropolis and Gotham. It also explores, as have I, the idea of the splitting of the infinite. And along the way, a great sketch of lots of characters, some infighting between artists, writers, editors, and mythical owners and Stan Lee types, with nods to X-Men, the Avengers, Fantastic Four, and the movies and culture they have inspired. I love the book, and in many ways, it's the novel I had wanted to write from when I was a little kid, when my parents used to dismantle the universe at night when I was asleep and only put together the pieces I needed for the next day, so there was no Syria, no Benghazi, no Concords, or heavy lifting bodies. Along the way, our prescient protagonist, Alex, in love with his mom, Val, meeting his dad, Andrew, good and bad guy, he runs into all kinds of interesting friends and acquaintances like Brad and Fred and Val's mom. And there was a tragedy, a heartfelt tragedy on the way. It was a great book, and I finished it in one sitting. So with that, welcome, Bob, and thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Want to hear something cool?
Yes.
So last night after I finished reading your novel at 2, so my Fitbit said I got 3 hours of sleep because I woke up at 7, much of it restless, and because I'm old, interrupted by trips to the bathroom. So I'm exhausted today and need tons of coffee. But the cool thing is, after I finished, I fell asleep, and I dreamed some more of your book. And in it, Brett or Val starts writing Alex after he's with Andrew. First they write letters every day, then every week, then every month, then they stop. And the letters are returned in blank envelopes with no postage, which Brett says are delivered because the Postal Service knows there's a letter inside with postage on it, so they cut them some slack, although the real Postal Service would never do that. Finally, one letter comes from Alex, and he writes like 500 questions, each beginning in five sentences or less, tell me why you let me leave. In five sentences or left, tell me why you did not stop me. In five sentences or left, how will I get back? Or why were you so uncaring? All of which are anathema to the real Alex, but quite familiar to me, thus my 20 years of therapy. Okay, I ask you questions now. So I think you would fit right into your characters. Do you? It seems like you would.
I would fit into them?
Yeah, you know, like, if you were really cool, you would be Brett. I mean, but you could be really uncool and be Fred. But the point I'm trying to make is that you seem to be the kind of person with your history and career that could slide into this book fairly easily.
I mean, it's very much a book about the world that I've kind of inhabited as a fan of all these things for such a long time. Although the one funny thing I will say is that, you know, I wrote this book sort of in my early 30s, and the hardest character to write was Brett, who's kind of an early 20, an analog of me in my late 20s. It was it's really odd to sort of think myself back into that period of my life. That was the toughest character to click for me.
Brett's such a nice guy, but he's also quite naive and makes mistakes. And as he says to Alex, you know, Alex says, well, have you done that? And he goes, no, but I'm going to try and start, you know, being the kind of guy that says, okay, this is, you know, in my life when people say to me, I think I'm going to write a novel. I think I'm going to start working out. It means they're never going to do either of those things.
And yeah, he's a bit of a stumbling character. And that, again, for writing a novel, that can be troubling to have a character that doesn't strongly want anything, that isn't striving, that is maybe just getting ready or getting to that point in his life where he feels like he needs to start striving for something.
He's a really nice guy, though.
Yeah, he's a good kid.
So everyone's kind of nice, pretty much, except for when you get up to the upper echelons of the comic world where there's the usual business infighting. The only one is Andrew. And it's like, at the end of the book, I mean, I'm kind of thinking that Andrew's not good, but there's a part of him that seems to have turned. Did you feel like the reader has this choice to decide whether he's trying to be better?
I think I worked really hard, especially in later drafts of the book, to make Andrew a little more sympathetic. Initially, you know, the way the book was first written, he was very much a sort of cardboard cutout villain. And, you know, one of the consequences of using a really simplistic villain is that your heroes end up really simplistic too. And so making him more complicated and making him more sympathetic really let me color the other characters in different ways, sort of in response to him. But yeah, I think by the end, I wanted the reader to not be quite sure how they felt about Andrew, rather than just sort of clenching their fists and saying, oh, this guy's ruining everything.
Yeah, the only thing is at the very end when he puts the plant in the audience about the movie, then I thought, yeah, he really is a scoundrel. But that was that brought it back to the bad side. But
yeah. Yeah, he's not a great guy. And I wanted the sense to be that he's getting through that phase in his life where he's not a good guy, where he's completely self-centered, but he's not out of it yet.
No. It's like he's trying. Like when he's taking the water and from the Pacific and like going between hands with it. That was like a good metaphor in a way. You know, he's just not sure. He's not sure how to sit on the bed.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that's really good the way you did this with your characters. I think what's really good is like the way the characters, you know, they have accents, but you don't have accents in there. But you know how Val's mom talks, and you know how the comic book guys talk when they make their little speeches or walk into the room. You can tell that they have these accents, and I don't know how quite know how you did it, but it's interesting because I was interviewing this guy, Arturo Perez Reverte, this Argentinian writer, Spanish writer actually, who wrote this book. What was it called? Something like How We Became, or something like that. But anyway, he was really good at portraying characters, how they dressed, the lighter they used, the Dunhill. He was reading a Patek Philippe watch, stuff like that, and the rooms and the clothes and all that. And I said, how do you do this? How do you make it so clear? And he says, I don't do it. The reader does it.
Exactly. I mean, that's, you put just enough on the page that the reader is sort of making that last leap to you. You know, I think particularly, like, I don't like doing big physical descriptions of characters for that very reason. I don't want to preclude certain ways that the reader, and I think it's more true the more central a character is. I don't want to preclude ways that the reader might visualize that character. So, you know, people ask, I've done these interviews and people are like, well, who would you cast as so-and-so? And some people come in with really interesting ideas about that. And I'm like, I actually don't know. I didn't put those physical traits there because that's work that you want to let the reader do for themselves.
Yeah, there's this book called What Do We See When We Read? So it's like if you're reading Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher. You know it's this mansion, and you know it's in disrepair, but what do you really see? And I thought,
right.
You know, I don't know. I don't know what I see. I know what I see, but you know, you actually have to uncast people in this book, because when you have Andrew doing Ted Kemen, which is like going from X-Files to Californication, so you kind of have to uncast him out of the X-Files, don't you? I mean, that's what it's like.
I think so, yeah. I mean, those, you know, we do start with two characters who are very direct analogs to actual people and actual celebrities. And I hope that effectively that gets undone, and that people aren't just hearing David Duchovny read the lines. Because it certainly wasn't that way for me. And it started, you know, they started as simple analogs to plug in simple places to start, and then the characters really drifted from there and moved away from those real people or from those personas and became their own, became characters on their own.
I think that Alex drives that a lot. Like when he's talking to Fred and he says, he gets upset and he goes, "You adults are so stupid, you know. These things, you get into these fights and all, but that's because you don't say what you mean when it happens." And, you know, which is such a intelligent kid thing to say, because it's so true, and it's true however old you get. But I know this one girl, like Alex, she's 8. And last night I told her about my daughter's entrance exam to college. And she goes, "Does that mean she just has to know how to walk through the door and get in?" I thought that was pretty funny. So then I told her, I said, "I'm reading this book about, and it's about this little boy in a cave and a broken robot and this little girl that comes in." And she looks at me and she goes, "Hmm." And that was it. And it reminded me so much of Alex. But you only meet a few kids like that in your lifetime, don't you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think the way kids think generally is fascinating, and you do have to engage with them to get at that. You know, the way kids like present to a stranger, and the way they talk, or the way you get to see them think when you get to know them better, are vastly different things. And really, that's something that I wanted to get across with this book, is that like kid thinking is not a proto version of adult thinking. It's something very different and very of itself. And so watching how kid thinking processes like language, emotion, and narrative, those are really like pretty central to what I wanted to talk about in this book.
Yeah, it's like when Andrew's trying to figure out how to act towards Alex, and he goes, like, you know, the usual, "How you doing, champ?" Kids see through. They don't like that. It's like when you see your aunt, she goes, "Ooh, look how big you are. Last time I saw you, you were like this size." Kids don't like that. Nobody, you know, it's just, but if you just say to a kid when you walk up, "Hey, how you doing? What's up?" Like Brett does, then the kid, like when they talk about their commission, yeah, that was a good one, commission. Like the entrance exam. But, yeah, then they're fine. But you have to realize as an adult, you have to realize that you were once a kid, and you have to remember or still be that kind of way, which closes some doors but keeps other doors open.
Yeah, and I think fandom is one of those spaces that you can return to that kind of thinking like a kid. You know, whether it's stuff like comics and sci-fi and genre fiction or music or whatever, like that kind of like raw enthusiasm has something really similar to kid thinking about it, and that's why I really wanted to set this book in those environments and in those worlds, is to sort of look at the overlap of those two things.
Yeah, in a couple of your interviews you allude to that, and I've always kind of thought, okay, you know, you can have Excel and you can have really cool apps, and you can have your Fitbit, and you can have all this stuff, but I always thought that what's going to happen is through the back door is going to come gaming and comics and things like that, and that's going to be, people are, unbeknownst to them now, that's going to be the way the future occurs. And you kind of allude to that a little bit in some of your talks. Do you agree?
I think those things are having this huge cultural moment. You know, comic books or superheroes are sort of culturally ubiquitous, which was not, and it's happened so quickly that it's tough to look back and think back to a time when that wasn't the case. But like, it was very much, when I was a kid, a niche market. And my voice just cracked as if I were that actual 13-year-old going to this comic book store to get his Batman fix. But one of the neat things about comics is that even at this moment of, you know, superhero cultural ubiquity, the number of comic book readers is really small, and that fandom is really, like, has a sense of community that's pretty unique.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I have a 16-year-old girl working at the bookstore, Claire, you know, and she's always going to Comic-Cons, and she's always into anime and cosplay and all that, and it's her whole world, and it's all her friends' whole world. And I have mixed feelings about that, because I don't know if it closes a part of the living day-to-day reality of their lives, or whether it's just the direction that things are going in. Because I don't know anything about it. I can't keep up with it. I always thought I'd be ahead of the curve, but I'm so far behind now, it's there's no way I can catch up.
I don't think it closes you off to anything. You know, I mean, I think it depends. And there are sections of these fandoms that I'm not engaged in. Like, I'm not a video gamer. I haven't been, or a gamer, but like, those things particularly very often are community oriented. They're social. And I think it may not be the way that we think of that living in the world as how living in the world functions, but it is a way of being in the world.
Well, kind of, but it's like when you go to dinner at a restaurant and you look at a family next to you of a mother and father and two kids, and all four of them are looking down at their device. You know, the kids have forgotten what it's like to recognize facial expressions. Or when you text your girlfriend and she doesn't text you back for an hour, and you're frantic because you think that the relationship is done. Those kinds of things.
Well, I mean, these are augmentary things. These are auxiliary things. And I think rather than, you know, decrying what's being lost, we need to start looking at what can be gained, and what if we graft all these other worlds, whether they're imaginative worlds or like social media worlds, onto what we think of as day-to-day reality, like what is the possibility? What can that look like? How can we make day-to-day reality better by adding these things to them, rather than what you're talking about, which is to just sort of leaving and checking out of this, of what's going on day-to-day? Are there ways that we can enhance it with these other tools, many of which are narrative tools?
Yeah. For some reason, that brings me back to what we were talking about before the show, which is the idea of, I don't know why, it's totally irrelevant, but the idea, which I've shared since I was a little kid, that the universe is constantly splitting off. So in one universe, we're not having this talk. One universe, you didn't write this book. In one universe, you wrote the book, but you changed one word. And even down to even thinner and thinner and thinner slices. But I like the way you said, if you turn around, or if you look over your shoulder, the line behind you is a single straight line, because it's your timeline. And but since we have an infinite amount of space and time, there's absolutely no reason why there can't be an infinite number of realities that exist for you or everybody. I've always agreed with that. Is that kind of the way you feel about it? I mean, it's not like a proposition to me. It's actually the way I feel.
I think for me, where that comes in is in the idea of like conceiving of self, and like how you think of yourself, and whether you think of yourself as being sort of singular and locked in, or being multiple. And I think more and more, and some of this has to do with operating in different worlds, you know, like having a social media persona, or having a gaming persona, or having, you know, the person that I am when I'm being interviewed about my book versus the person that I am when I'm playing with my baby, having a sense of like access to these multiple selves. And I think that's great. And I think for me, that's a much healthier way of conceiving of myself as multiple and as myriad, rather than this sort of like 70s therapy idea of like trying to find yourself, you know, find this one consistent way that you are.
Yeah. I just got a catalog yesterday, and I think it's Harbinger Press, and all their books are about this, I've forgotten the name, it begins with an A, Atavita or something like that, and all it's about is duality or non-duality. And if that's the case, it kind of collapses the wave function on our theories, because if you just look at it as being, if you can eliminate the duality of your existence and just embrace it as one thing, then you don't have, all those past universes collapse into the thing you're in now. Not that
yeah, I just don't find that interesting. You know, that's not the world or set of worlds that I want to live in. So I'm gonna live in this other one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of what, when you bring it down to basics, that's kind of what Brett's telling Alex in their last long talk. That's the nuts and bolts of it, is that you even say it, you know, you write the story. You just have to do it. You have to write the story, otherwise the story writes you.
Right. And I mean, similarly, like, you choose the person that you want to be. You choose the self that you want to be. And I think the idea that there's a kind of a priori version of yourself is one that I hope culturally we're moving away from, because I think a lot of times people trying to find that ends up being kind of destructive and mentally wrenching, because you go on this search for something that's perhaps ultimately not there.
Yeah, it's like when Alex wakes up the first morning in his new bedroom and is thinking of his mom, and then he thinks, I'm not going to do this again. But then he can't live with it that way, so he has to, like, shout it or say it out loud firmly. That's what's so cool about Alex. And that's why he's the one who calls the shots. He's the one who tells his mother everything's going to be okay. She's the one that has issues with leaving him. He understands the issues, but he just says, it's going to be okay. You know, I'll deal with it. And that's really hard for parents. I know, as a parent of four kids, I know exactly how that feels.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there are ways that we protect our kids, and there are ways that our kids protect us. And there's a constant negotiation there. And I think part of this book was exploring that sort of, that pushback, and the fact that, like, there's a reason you let them go. There's a reason you let the tether out a little bit. And sometimes it has to be coming from their end, coming from the kids saying, like, you know what, I've got this. And as parents, we have to stand back and watch them stumble a little bit. And often that's more painful for us as parents than it is for them.
I know. It's like when Val's mom lets him go in the woods and follow the trail and the excitement of being lost. And or like when he tells Brett his mom said it was okay to take him down to the store, and then the mother reacts the way she does. I mean, the kid's in total control of the situation, but the parents are going berserk, which you know exactly how that feels.
Right.
And the thing is what's really weird is the stuff you worry about is never the thing that happens. What happens is you get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, what happens is like what happens with Rachel and Tim.
Yeah, I mean, I think being a parent is just part of it. Is just existing in this constant fear state. Huh. And like you said, it's never what you thought it was going to be. When disaster strikes, it's not the one that you planned for.
Yeah,
which doesn't mean you shouldn't plan for the 17 other disasters, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't be ready, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't protect your kids. But like, ultimately, like, the bubble you try to keep them in is going to pop.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, there's this Zen thing, like, don't suffer twice. I mean, because you're suffering the whole time before it happens, then you're going to suffer when it happens, so especially if it doesn't, because you're suffering all that time. But, yeah, and then, you know, some of the other guys, you must really like Crab Rangoon, right?
I love Crab Rangoon.
Yeah.
It's probably, description-wise, it is the most disgusting thing that I love.
Well, I like, you know,
one of those things that you can't conceptually sell anyone on it. If you can convince them to eat it, they will probably love it. But if you describe it to them first, they're that much less likely to love it.
As long as it's fried. I mean, I fried tripe one time and it was good. And tripe is like it's a mesentery of an animal, but but it was okay. It was like, but you could deep fry cardboard; it would be all right. But
I think that ends with Oreos. Oreos are actually not as good as conceptually they should be.
Have you ever been to those carnivals where they have deep fried everything?
Yeah, that's when I ran into the Oreo problem.
Yeah, yeah. It's a disgusting thing to even look at the sign.
Yeah.
But it is kind of, so you like Chinese food and you like the appetite. Like you probably ordered the poo-poo platter when you were a kid and laughed about what it was called.
Yeah, I didn't grow up eating Chinese food. That's all stuff that, like, when I went to college and you know, the tether snapped a little bit. That was all kind of new to me when I was in my late teens, which is like kind of the ideal time to be discovering Chinese food. It's a great thing for one's teenage years.
Plus, if you don't eat it all, you can dump it all in a frying pan, break an egg into it, and just mix it all up, and it tastes just as good. Which I do for my kids for breakfast. And then also with hot dogs, like in Chicago. And this happened the same day. Like, you know, Gail says, don't put ketchup on it. You want to look like a tourist. And I went to this restaurant yesterday, and they had hot dogs, and they had an asterisk on the menu, and they said, we also have ketchup if you must. Because who would put ketchup on a hot dog in the first place? It's ridiculous.
You know, you don't sit down to write a novel thinking that it's going to be this didactic mechanism, but I do want to get word out there that, like, you know, you shouldn't be putting ketchup on your hot dogs.
You made it clear. I mean, I've made it. If I ever see anybody do it, with my personality, as you might be able to tell, I'm just going to yell at them. It's ridiculous. It's a stupid thing to do. You're ruining your life.
Some people just, if that's the way you're brought up, some people just don't know the right way to do it.
I'm sorry. I'm going to tell them it's wrong. They need to rethink. Some of the other guys you like the curator, who's really well painted. And so, okay, he's Doctor Who, and he's been going on for 50 years. So, I mean, I think it's really cool, but what's the idea? What do I take away from it? What's the reader supposed to take away from it? Because if you have a reader who's not conversant with this stuff, he looks at it on one level, which is kind of good because they do that with kids' books all the time too. But is it just kind of like you want the reader to be not necessarily nostalgic about it, but happy that Doctor Who's in the book? Or how did you...
the curator is probably the nerdiest thing that didn't get cut in editing. that was like, I was so self-satisfied with the multiple layers of Doctor Who jokes that I worked in there. And a lot of that kind of stuff, a lot of the stuff that was super in-jokey, got cut because it wasn't doing anything for the plot. So the curator had to show up, and I really desperately wanted him to stay in the book. So I needed to work that chapter and so that it functioned as part of Val and Alex's story. And so he is in there to sort of let her have this moment where she's reflecting on herself as a parent, reflecting on her career, reflecting on where she's at currently in her career, but also allow me to do this sort of bit of fan service and Easter egg thing where there's a multivalent Doctor Who joke in there.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's almost like Matrix-like, like, you know, he's like the creator, you know, and because he's so, he knows who he is, he knows what he's been, he knows he's not that anymore. But the cool thing is that you've already turned Alex into like this real superhero instead of a created superhero. But you really amplify it by making it that he can actually tie a bow tie.
Well, he learned.
Yeah, he learned, but that would be really hard to do.
Right, right. No, I didn't manage to effectively teach myself how to do it.
I can't do it. Wait a minute, you did or you didn't?
I did not.
Did you try it while you were writing the book? Did you try standing in the mirror?
I did try, and I think if I had dedicated myself a little more to it, but I was like, you know what, I can just give the instructions, and maybe it can be a try this at home moment. It's another moment where the novel can be a sort of a teaching mechanism.
Well, there is a book
Don't put ketchup on your hot dogs and learn to tie a bow tie.
There is a book called How to Tie a Tie at my bookstore, and I've tried it, but I can never do like the full Windsor or any of those things.
I can't do a Windsor. I do a four in hand. My dad taught me to do a four in hand, and it's the only tie knot that I know how to do. And it's the more complicated. It's not as... It's the big fat knot.
Yeah, I like that.
I like it too, but I don't know how to do... I've never been able to switch into a Windsor, and I certainly cannot do a bow tie.
My father used to say to me, you tie a tie worse than anyone I've ever seen in my life. That's the kind of father I have, but... He was very loving and all that, but he would just spit those things out, kind of like I do now. But, yeah, you could never
get... It's one of those things that I can't teach on somebody else. Like, whenever I've had to tie my kid's tie, I have to put it on myself
and then,
do it that way, because doing the reverse just causes my brain to melt down.
Well, it's worse for me because I'm left-handed.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, that I think that's part of it. My dad was left-handed, so a lot of these basic skills... learn to do with my non-dominant hand. That's why I'm a terrible pool player.
Well, there's lots of things that you have to learn. Like, my dad was too cheap to buy me left-handed golf clubs, so I never really... That's your pulling hand, and I never really learned how to play golf well because I didn't get left-handed clubs. lots of things. But now irons are good because you can switch the cord on the back of irons. You know, you can take the plate off of the back and switch the cord.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So anyway, so like you have a chapter all watched over by Machines of Loving Grace, which is from Richard Brautigan originally, you know, Watermelon Sugar, which was when I was 16 and you were unborn by 40 years. But yeah, that was like my favorite book of all time when I read that. And then I was really sad when he died, but not as sad as I was when David Foster Wallace died.
Yeah. Yeah, I went through a pretty major Brautigan phase, as one does.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to Grievous Angel. And how come you wrote the 33 and a third for that? I mean, you're too young to be like thinking of those things. I mean, it's back
to
Buffalo Springfield and stuff.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, 33 and a third is a great series. It's a series I've always been a fan of, and they do an open call for proposals. Every year or two, or at least they used to. I'm not sure that they still do. And so they put out the open call, and I remember like going out to the bar that night and saying to all my friends, like, "Hey, let's all write book proposals." And all my friends kind of looked at me as you would when somebody says that. And I was probably a bigger fan of Parsons' solo stuff, and the book is actually about the Flying Dorito Brothers, the band that he was in sort of after the Birds and before going solo and before pairing up with Emmylou Harris. When I started thinking about that band, they come at this weird cultural nexus of sort of the end of the 60s and the beginning of what becomes country rock in the 70s, and I got really interested in this idea of a band that forms around the friendship of two people and then just dissolves and degrades really quickly. And so that band in that iteration really only existed for 2 or 3 years. And by the time they recorded their second album, they were already coming apart.
Right. It's a great story of self-destruction, and it's like the height of his, it's as high as he got. And then everything from then, you know, ended horribly.
Yeah, I also didn't like the narrative around Gram Parsons that centered around his death. And, you know, I think it's something that often happens, and it happened a bit with David Foster Wallace, too. Like, suddenly everything about him gets read through his suicide. And it was the case with Parsons, too. Like, a lot of people read everything about him as sort of leading up to his death by overdose. And I was like, yeah, I'm not really interested in that. I'm interested in looking at him and thinking about him when he's alive and when he's a working artist.
Yeah, I know. That's why I didn't like that stupid movie about David Foster Wallace, but I forgot what it was called. The Rolling Stone interview one?
Yeah, I don't remember what they ended up going with the title. I read the book version of it. I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, it doesn't. And then after you die, if you're popular, then they start publishing your commencement exercises speeches, like they did This Is Water.
Yeah, but I
like that though.
They're looked as, you know, they get looked at as part of a diagnosis, and they're not, you know, and this isn't, it's not new. Like, people do the same thing with Sylvia Plath poems. Like, not every Sylvia Plath poem is about how she ended up dying.
Well,
there are other things, there are other tones that she's doing. Can we look at those? And it was the same thing with writing about Parsons. It's like, not everything had to be about where he ends up.
Well, like, you know, classic, I guess, would be Ernest Hemingway, too. But the thing about Ernest Hemingway is everyone in his family committed suicide. You know, it's like, if you ever read about it, there's like his brother, his sister, his father, his granddaughter.
Right.
They all kill themselves. So that's kind of weird. But, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. The problem is that you kind of want to say, hey, you know, I read Infinite Jest like a long time ago, and now you're reading it because the guy's dead. It's like someone telling you something's a great movie when you saw it a long time ago before it was what it was. And you want to say something, but it would be really, you'd be kind of a jackass to say it.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with people who discover these artists, you know, after or as a result of their death. I just, it worries me when you go into a piece like that, like Infinite Jest, looking for clues, you know, for pointers towards, like, oh, we can clearly see in 1996 that this was going to happen.
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of authors, his friends, well, you know, and he was depressed for so long and was on medication for so long, he then didn't take it. So I think a lot of people, and he attempted before, so I think a lot of people were trying to save him, not necessarily making up the backstory, but they were trying to save him from what they thought was a pretty good possibility. But the main thing is what he wrote was amazing. So that's still
right.
The main thing. Which is true of, you know, the thing is, I have all these 33 and a third books in there and no one buys them. And I push everyone back there. Sorry.
Yeah, I know.
But
probably mine least of all.
Well, no one knows what it is except you and me. I mean, but Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, I want to say you got to buy this. You know, it's Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. So buy it. But it doesn't seem to work that well. Although I can do it with the Oxford University Brief Introduction books. Those I can get people to buy easy.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing with the 33 and a third series is that the popularity of the album does not necessarily map onto the quality of the book.
Oh, yeah.
Or not even popularity, but like quality of the album. Like, my favorite book in that series is Carl Wilson's Let's Talk About Love. It's his book on Celine Dion. It's fantastic. And I have no interest in listening to that Celine Dion album, but he uses it as this mechanism to talk about taste and culture and like cultural capital, and it's just a fantastic book.
I hate Celine Dion. But I will say this, the curator has good teeth, but when he smiles that lopsided smile, it's kinda like Celine Dion's smile. Although, I don't know why you think of these things. It makes no sense. So maybe subconsciously you did do that. Who knows? what else was I going to ask you about? Oh, yeah. So I bought this Oxford University, the little one called Nothing. It was a brief introduction to Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I lost it. So I had Nothing. But then I found it, and then I had Nothing again. So I lost Nothing. I found Nothing, and then I had Nothing.
So, that's a good introduction and brief.
I know. That was it. But they have one called The Void, so I got to figure out what's the difference between Nothing and The Void. There's a good book. Oh, speaking of which, so all the girls, women who dress up and are all absolutely beautiful, especially Ferret Lass, who's, you know, really incredibly hot. You know, Brett can't even believe how hot she is. So, but then you have this whole feminist kind of side to it. But as a guy reading it, I'm really interested in the dressing room, all these women talking to each other. So did you, like, because Gail obviously debunks all of that, as do some of them in the dressing room too. But where did that all come about?
Well, part of that was I really wanted to have a Greek chorus of superhero characters. So that was sort of where that began. And then the character of Ferret Lass sort of left the chorus and entered into the story. And you can see her actually sort of leave that group, and we don't see her in that group again as she becomes part of the main story. But I also wanted to keep her... She was a character that I very intentionally denied subjectivity to, because we really only see her through Brett, and I wanted that to be a bit of a critique. Like I wanted to give the reader the sense that, like, something that's going on here with him is not okay, and is the sort of the male gaze, it is objectification, and that's why, like, that's why we never get her name. That's why until the end we don't really have any sense of, like, what's going on with her or what her actual interests are. So it was a chance to set up getting to look at what that looks like, to look at what objectification looks like, and then have other characters like Gail and like the rest of the chorus come in to provide a critique of it.
But if you look at her, she's almost... it's almost like she's an enlightened being. And maybe that's part of what California and LA are all about. But everything is fine. She smiles at everything. She wants to know, just incidentally, what Brett does to Val on that given night. And she's laughing about it. And I need to give me the sort of details later on. But everything is fine. And when he says, what do you want to do? Get married? Live together? She goes, no, just come out. Hang out. If it doesn't work, you walk out. I walk out. No arguments. And everything is always incredibly calm. She comes over and does the emergency makeup job. She leaves and goes out while he's drawing and comes back and slurs that she was with friends, which is a perfect thing to say. But everything about her is totally zen-like, in my mind.
It's totally zen-like. Oh.
Yeah. Or maybe it's just California. It's just, you know.
Well, I think, again, that's because we're really seeing her through him. And, you know, if I had done chapters that were from her point of view, then it's a very different character. And then, you know, the anxieties that she has sort of get brought to the table. And, you know, sort of what's implied there is, like, there's something performative about that. There's something about having to be the cool girl. And, it may look, since we're seeing her through Brett, as if she's pulling this off effortlessly, but the implication is it's actually through quite a lot of effort. And the metaphor for that is that, you know, when she comes in to fix makeup, that's sort of that. It's like, here's this mystifying thing that I'm going to do that you may or may not have noticed that we've been doing the whole time.
Yeah, I would disagree with you as the reader, but that's because I looked at it a different way. I think if you looked at it from her point of view, she would be exactly the same. She wouldn't have any anxieties. Well, the one thing we didn't talk about is, like, what controls the book and the idea man and all of that is that there's this, and I don't want to spoil it. I think we've been okay with spoilers thus far, but it's just like this major tragedy that is almost like the movie The Fisher King with Jeff Bridges.
Oh yeah, the Rob Williams Jeff Bridges movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like there's this tragedy that no one talks about, or at least Val doesn't talk about. But it's interesting. Why did you have her take Alex to Grumman's Chinese as kind of like this purgative kind of thing?
I think part of that was her dealing with the way she felt about Andrew as her ex-husband versus having to start to think about Andrew as Alex's father. And I think those two things can be very different. And, you know, we find her in this position where she needs to start thinking about him differently to keep her from just running away. And so it is kind of her coming to terms with what's happened and ultimately, like, the limits of what that story means for them and means for her. I mean, for Alex. It's a moment of deciding not to be defined entirely by what has happened and not to define Andrew entirely by what has happened.
Yes, one of the things you did really well, two things. Well, the whole book is great. But one was when Val visits the woman. That was really good. And also the scene in which the tragedy happens is almost like cinematic because it's like really, really quick cuts, you know? It's like half-second cuts in Game of Thrones. You know, it's like you know what's happening, but there's not, you know... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's tough writing about violence, particularly an incident of violence to women, and you want to be careful not to... You don't want to make it look too pretty. And, you know, you're writing and you want all of your writing to be pretty. So I did sort of try to create that scene by cutting away in a cinematic and editing sense. And yeah, it was a tough scene to write. That whole chapter was really difficult to construct and difficult to place in the narrative because we want to get that information at a certain point in the rest of the backstory.
Yeah, it's like, well, what about writing about sex? Because those scenes are handled really well too, but that's because they're relatively implicit. They're not explicit. Do you find that difficult too, or was this your first foray into actually even giving it a try, since you're kind of a geek and a nerd?
Yeah, I think... not to sound prudish or Victorian, but I think very often in writing, sex is best when it's implied.
Yeah, I agree. And it's never implied now. It's always explicit. But in so many older novels, well, actually, like I was just, this woman wrote a book about Everyone Behaves Badly. And it was a story of The Sun Also Rises and how it was written by Hemingway. But in The Sun Also Rises, you know there's this thing that happened. You know what it precludes, but it's never said. And when I first read it as a kid, I didn't know what it was. It was only when I read it again before I interviewed her that I kind of really thought, well, this was done really well, and it was done in 1924, and people accepted it.
Right. And then you contrast that with something like Henry Miller, and the latter comes off as sort of locker room talk.
Yeah.
I think it's... I'm trying to think who the quote is by, and I think the last time I've seen it attributed is Charles Bowden, who says that when we write about sex, we end up with recipes without food.
Right. Yeah.
And there's something you're not going to get at. It's not, I don't think sex and violence are things that literature does particularly well, or that literature does more poorly when it is more explicit.
And of course, traditionally, and I guess it's kind of a cliche now, is Lolita seems to have done it best in so many different ways. And, you know, as shocking as it might have seemed at that time, the way it was handled was the correct way to handle it, at least in my opinion.
Right. Well, I think we can write well about desire, but when it passed a certain point... it's difficult to render into words.
What was the one thing you said about fair or last, about what has Brett said, the only thing she looked better in, wait a minute, the only thing she didn't look better in than her costume was her voice. What was that? Wait, is that what you said? Do you remember
it? Oh, I don't remember it.
That's the problem.
I vaguely remember, I have a general sense of what you're talking about, but I can't.
It's so many times it's really interesting when I'm interviewing authors and I say, you remember this? And they go, no, tell me what I said. Or is that, or they go, is that, was that still in the book? I thought they took that out.
You know, it's a long, editorial is a long process and it's easy to lose track of what you ended up with. There have been a couple of times where I'm like, did I put the thing in there? Is the thing still in there about this?
So what are you going to do promoting this? Does it become something that actually is weird because it's kind of recursive? It's like, I mean, is this a Comic-Con kind of book?
I've actually, I've been to four so far, and I've been to four so far this year, and I've got at least two more. I'm going to be going to San Diego in July, and then just doing a bit of touring. You know, like we said, I'm going to be at Amalgam next week, or I'm going to be at Amalgam on the
5th. Tomorrow, whatever.
And then I'm doing, you know, some traditional bookstores, some comic book stores, mostly in the Northeast and sort of within, you know, sort of day trips from where I live. We've been taking it just with galleys and advanced copies. We've been going out to cons and I've been on panels, and it's been great. The response has been really good.
Yeah, I can see that. It's a really hard, you're not even in a niche or a genre because you have like three or four different things going on in the book. And that's why someone was asking me today, is it a science fiction book? And I said, no. And they said, well, wait a minute. No, well, maybe, I don't know. And then I realized, it's not science fiction. It has nothing to do with science fiction. But it doesn't, you know, it does seem like it is, doesn't it? Kind of?
It's, you know, it's about those things without being one of them. And there are certainly, there are elements of science fiction and of superhero stories in the stories that are being told in the book. But the central story of the book is this, is a family story, is this, this mother and son story.
You know, I really liked was Gale. Gale was like in one of those goofball movies, like in the 30s, like His Girl Friday and all that, where, you know, she's just like so funny and such a klutz and a goofball. And but there's so many, there's lots of lines in there that I remember, but I like when she says, oh, so you were with that girl Ferret last. She seems like a good egg.
She was the, you know, Gale was only created to be in one scene, and then she just kept showing back up as I kept writing the book, and sometimes when like a scene didn't feel like it was working, there'd be this little voice that would say, like, how would that scene work if, say, Gale was in it? And I would try it that way, and it would just, the scene would sort of, would come alive. She was by far the most fun character to write.
That was a great line, because especially followed by, although she had never really actually said those words in her life, you know, good egg. And then the scene where she goes into the bathroom and kind of semi locks the door so no one can get in. But what about that thing where he turns around and fastidiously washes his hands, which she interprets as meaning he never does wash his hands? Do you feel the same way? Do you ever not wash your hands? Do you wash your hands really well when someone's next to you?
I have never not washed my hands.
Yeah, but do you wash them better when someone's next to you?
Well, certainly.
Isn't that weird?
That is strange, yeah. And that was what I wanted that scene was like. The idea of this, you know, of a space that is perhaps not seen being seen for the first time. The washing of hands joke was an easy way to do that.
And also, like, when he walks out and he says, can we continue this discussion in some place, yes, less urination? But he turns out to be a good guy, too, I think. I'm not sure. But the idea of cockroach heads and her allusions to Kafka's Metamorphosis were really good, too. I like that. But, All right. Well, look. Okay. That's it. We're done. It's 50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because neither of us are saying anything. So it must be done then. Okay. Well, so anyway, I think it's a great book. I think you did a really good job, and for being a first book, and who knows how you decided to do it and all that, but it's really good.
Thanks.
And like I said at the beginning, so you'll be at Amalgam, and I'm saying it'll be on June 30th, which is 3 days from now. And it's downtown. And if you don't know, if you're out here and you don't know, it's on Frankfort, which is really easy to find. And you can just GPS it or just take the train downtown. So anyway, thanks so much for coming today. I really enjoyed talking to you. And like I said, it's easy to ask questions when you remember everything about the book. And when you remember everything about the book, it means it's a good book. At least I think so.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome. Hey, that was Bob Prohl, who wrote 100,000 Words. It's a debut novel. First I started reading it, I was thinking, and then I got caught up in it, and it's really well done. It's really well written, and there's lots of phrases that you'll remember. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know that much about Comic-Cons or cosplay or just comics in general, except for when I was a kid and read Superman and Batman and talked about Gotham City and Metropolis and Krypton and places like that. But it really gives you an idea, especially if you're older and you don't know what's going on. This is a really good primer, whatever it is, on what is actually going on in the world that you might not know about. It's like if you don't know like what a Fitbit is, it would be like reading up on Fitbits. Here, you don't know what a Comic-Con is, you can figure out what it is exactly and how they work. So as usual, I'm really happy we got him here. And who's coming up? I think I said this on the last show, but Liz Moore, who came here and to the store to do a signing on her book Heft, which is about this really fat guy. And then the new one is The Unseen World, which I haven't read yet. And then Delia Ephron, who I said was Nora Ephron's daughter. It's not. It's her sister. Will share her latest book, which is called Syracuse. And the other one is by Scott, I forgot his last name, Stamach or something like that. He wrote The Invisible Life of Ivan Issaneko, which I also haven't read. But I assume since Rebecca picked them out that they're really good. So as always, as I end up everything, now I'm over an hour on this show, just check us out at Podomatic, iTunes, our website, the YouTube channels, and you can see what's going on. And thanks as always for actually being here and listening to this or listening to it on your computer. Again, iTunes is the easiest because you just type the guy's name in or the book or the Avid Reader. And I just checked it yesterday and it has every episode that I've ever done since 2010. So if you want to listen to me speak for at least 300 hours, you can just set it to auto, go to sleep, and wake up feeling absolutely horrible. Okay. So I'll see you. Thanks for joining us here on the Avid Reader.